Tech Sounds presents EduTrends.
Welcome to the EduTrends podcast presented by the Institute for the Future of Education. This is a Tech Sounds podcast, the official podcast of the Tecnológico de Monterrey. I am José Pepe Escamilla. I'm Associate Director of the Institute for the Future of Education. Today's guest is Ryan Baker, professor in the Graduate School of Education at University of Pennsylvania. Ryan, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me here. I appreciate it.
Thanks. So I would like to start with a personal question. So you've been working in math, science, and teaching learning and the application also of artificial intelligence and data science and education. What's the reason that you decided to, dedicate a big part of your life to education?
That's a good question. And I guess a lot of it was just that I feel like ultimately, human advancement comes down to human beings being able to do great things. And human beings are able to do great things if they have the opportunities to learn. And I felt like our system is around the world, and the system I grew up in, is so uneven with the opportunities it gives different people. So I got really excited by the potential of technology and education to equalize the playing field and help everybody kind of get more years of being able to contribute. A faster start on learning what they need to learn so they can move forward and do great things.
Thank you for your answer, Ryan. So you're a well-recognized researcher in data science, and particularly in analytics, learning analytics, no? And also in artificial intelligence. There's a lot of your recent work in artificial intelligence. Can you explain us why this and how these two fields are related? Why is that there is a relationship between them or not?
Artificial intelligence and education?
And data science.
Data science, okay. So there's a long period where they weren't all that closely related, right? Like for a long time, data and education was very limited. It was one teacher maybe knowing about kids, or it was a school knowing the grades of kids. It was very limited, but data science has kind of revolutionized field after field, so that more information just allows us to answer more questions, allows us to know more things. And education has turned out to be no exception. The amount of data that gets created when a kid uses a learning platform or, a game, there's just so much data that's produced, and we can use that data to learn so much about the child, to learn their engagement, to learn whether they have the ability to, self-regulate during their learning, what their learning strategies are, what they know. And so we can use this to get a better picture of the student and then to do something about it, whether it's building a more adaptive learning platform or providing that information to a teacher or somebody else who can use that information to help the kid. And ultimately, education creates data, and we can use that data to help support education, make it better.
So that's the application of data science in education, no? Which is a very large area. But my question was more if there is a relationship between data science and artificial intelligence, because you're good in both.
I see. My apologies for misunderstanding.
Oh, that's also.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, artificial intelligence runs on data. And that might not be obvious when people use something like ChatGPT, because they're not putting in lots of data. They're putting in simple prompt. But it was trained. The model was developed using massive amounts of data. And the ways they did that made it possible so that now they don't need as much to operate the model. The data science kind of is the underpinning of all artificial intelligence. And if nowadays artificial intelligence has gotten so sophisticated that it doesn't need as much data day-to-day, it still needed it in the first place.
Okay, so there's that relationship is because there are many of the techniques and methodologies needed to use data or to train models with data are somehow similar.
Well, I wouldn't even say similar. What I would say is that it was the work of data science that so ultimately, data science is making meaning from information, right? You've got some data, and you want to make meaning from it. One of the most common uses of that data in data science is to do prediction. So you might predict, say, from a kid's grades, what they're going to get on a test. Or you might predict, if you're a bank, from somebody's financial transactions, whether they're going to default on a loan. And with the artificial intelligence, what we call artificial intelligence today, the large language models, and incidentally, the term artificial intelligence really meant data science 5 years ago. But what we call artificial intelligence today, these large language models, they're actually just predicting the next word, and then predicting the next word after that, and the next word after that. It's actually the exact same thing under the hood, that task of prediction. It's just that today's AI models were trained with just so much data and with algorithms that could make use of that data, that predictive capacity became something that people didn't expect 8 years ago. It just, an emergent new kind of capability came out.
It's like the ability to predict what's the next word, not in a sentence, for instance.
It became the ability to create paragraphs. It became the ability to answer questions because it could predict. When you type in the ChatGPT, what is the capital of Mexico? It actually tries to predict what the answer would be to that question. Like if you were to see, what is the capital of Mexico? What would be the next text you'd see? And the most common answer would be, it is Mexico DF.
So it's a very nice way of looking at data science and AI in education. Thanks for your answer, Ryan. You took out large language models, and so these models that can allow us to do things like the things that ChatGPT or Google Gemini does. I know that you're working on the use of large language models in your university. In particular, I would like to know about Penn's GPTA.
Sure. So GPTA is our GPT. GPT is one of the large language model algorithms. It's what's inside ChatGPT. And we put GPT inside a discussion forum. What we did was we gave GPT, we put into its knowledge base my syllabus for my class, my lecture slides, my homeworks, and all of my posts from the last 3 years of the discussion forum. And so we said, respond like you're Ryan. And so it tries to respond like it's Ryan. If a student asks a question, it tries to respond like it was me. If a student asks, makes a comment, it tries to respond like it's me. And if they post, we even have a thing now where we gave it the grading from past semesters for my class and said, students should put in the first draft of their assignments and it'll give them feedback like it was me. And instead of taking 2 weeks, it'll give them feedback right away. And then we have them revise their work based on that feedback. And then and only then do I grade it. So it gives students the opportunity to get richer, faster, better feedback for their questions. You know, for example, on evenings and weekends and 3 a.m. that I couldn't give otherwise. So we've scaled it now to 3 classes at Penn. We're hoping to scale it to more next semester. And it's other universities are doing initiatives like this as well. I haven't seen any published papers on those initiatives, but I'm looking forward to seeing them. I'm sure that your university has some generative AI initiatives as well.
Yes, we do. So if I can verify my understanding of what you just said, GPTA is a private instance of GPT in the university where you upload several interactions that you have had with your students in the past so that you can have an artificial intelligence that can somehow replicate Ryan Baker also as a professor in that context.
Exactly. It's trying to imitate me and also my teaching assistants from the past 3 times I taught the class. But to go technical for a second, it is not an instance of GPT. It is a addition of knowledge through embeddings and fine tuning. But for those in the audience who that those terms aren't very meaningful to, I just wanted to be precise on that. Basically, we're giving it the information, and we are asking it explicitly to try to imitate me. And its imitation is not perfect. It's a little more pompous than I like to think I am. Its responses are a little bit pompous, sometimes a little bit repetitive. But nonetheless, students last semester rated it as being, in most dimensions, no worse than a human teaching assistant. The only things that they thought of were worse than were things that were pretty obvious, like emotional support. It's much worse than emotional support, they thought, than a human being. But in terms of factual responses, they thought it was comparable.
They're very interesting. So I would like to ask you, how much work those professor that wants to do this has to put in place to do the same thing that you did? I know you have a lot of knowledge on the field, no? But how difficult is to do this in terms of time or?
Well, first of all, if a professor wants to do it, I'd encourage them to reach out to my team. We're happy to help them. We would actually love to partner with people at more universities. That's the first answer. The second one is it really wasn't that bad. So granted that our team has some expertise already in these technologies, but it was about 6 hours of my time for the first course, which was the hardest. First course took much longer than the second, third, and fourth courses. It was about 6 hours of my time and about maybe half a person month to two-thirds of a person month for a research faculty member and about the same amount of time for two master students. So we're talking that basically about like in the ballpark of two and a half person months, which really isn't bad for setting us up, and much faster for the next time we set it up because we kind of knew what worked and what didn't, and we're able to build on our existing prompts.
Very, very interesting, because compared to the time and effort that the development of, a chatbot with other kind of technologies, more traditional AI, I would say, or will take much more time and effort.
It's mind-boggling. For example, it's been estimated that the amount of time taken to develop Cognitive Tutor, a year of Cognitive Tutor content, is six person years. And it's been estimated that AutoTutor, which is a chat-based intelligent tutoring system, previous generation, I think I read that it's like 200 hours of human effort for 1 hour of content. So the ratio, it doesn't map exactly, but the ratio is way better now. It's way easier to build these things. And while they're not perfect, they're pretty darn good.
Yeah, it's relatively low cost for the results, because as you say, that tutor or that replica for Ryan and the TAs are available 24 hours, 7 days a week. What are the things that are still a problem? So I've heard that chat with people that are doing things similar to this work. There's a Mexican startup working on this, Skills Tech is the name of the startup. So they are working on having a first layer of our GPT that is more like a teaching layer somehow. And then the next layer will be like the Ryan layer or the Pepe layer or the whatever layer to put my personal touch, no? When I'm a professor or a teaching assistant. And one of the problems is also hallucinations, no? Which is these answers that ChatGPT and others tend to give of things that are not true or doesn't exist.
So I've definitely seen that in my own personal everyday use of ChatGPT and other large language models. But surprisingly, I was expecting a lot more of that in my course. And so we actually put in a thing for the first semester where I had to approve every post. And I didn't approve every post, but it turned out I don't think I had a single case where I didn't approve a post in my course because of hallucinations. It was all because of tone being off, or in one case, it decided it wanted to pick a fight with one of the TAs over when their office hours were, which we didn't want to pass on to students. This semester, it sometimes is a little bit rambly and just keeps responding to every post in a thread with the same kind of stuff over and over. By surprise, we have not had any hallucination problems in my class. And my best guess for that is that that's simply because we put in enough information directly relevant to the course topics. And between that and its knowledge base for our topic domains, we haven't seen any problems with that. I guess it once gave the wrong information about a question about course logistics, but that was because actually the information in the syllabus was wrong. We'd updated the information to the students in class, but it hadn't updated the syllabus, and so it just had no way to know that. But we have not had the kind of wild, sometimes hallucinations you can get using ChatGPT in general.
Okay. Yeah, an interesting experience. You say that professors that are interested can contact you, but what should higher institutions do to integrate these tools like large language models into the learning experience?
Well, I mean, GPTA is just one way you can do it. And again, I welcome partnerships around the world. Beyond that, I mean, other projects in our center have integrated one of our projects, runcodeapp.org, has built better feedback for introductory computer science and for learning to program for introductory computer science. I think it can be generally good for feedback. I think in general, you can give it your grading from past semesters and ask it to imitate it, not to replace your grading, but to give students feedback faster, or if you want to, as a first draft on your grading, although I don't do it that way. You can use it as a tool for students to ask questions of, get explanations of. You can use it in foreign language classes as a way to have dialogues in the foreign language. There's just such a wide variety of things you can use it for. And often these things, to get it quite right, requires a little bit of tweaking, a little bit of tuning, but there's just different courses offer different opportunities, but the opportunities are just so broad and wide and awesome.
Do you think that in the future, let's say 10 years, all universities will be using AI in their learning experience, or even earlier?
I would never say all to any such question, because there are specialty universities like St. John's in the United States where they don't even use modern textbooks, where everything is with reference to classic great books. So do I think St. John's is likely to adopt this technology? No. But do I think that most universities are going to adopt it in a large proportion of their classes in some way? I very much do think so. Not everything is going to use it. Like take learning analytics for predicting who's going to drop out of college. A lot of colleges and universities use it, but mine doesn't. So there's always going to be exceptions. And similarly, there'll be professors who don't see the value or don't want to do that or want to focus on the things that it can't be as helpful for. So there will be exceptions, but I would expect to see much wider usage than we have today.
Yeah, I will agree with you. And I think that if we put the student at the center, there can be a lot of advantages, not for the student having this immediate feedback or answers or revisions on documents or whatever work they're doing. What I wonder is there are some universities that cannot take advantage of that because they don't have the human resources or the financial resources they will need to deliver this experience. I know that you know well Latin America, Brazil, you speak Spanish and Portuguese. And there's a digital divide in the region. No, still many universities that would benefit, as you say, from a predictive analytic tool to identify students in risk of dropping off are not generally used in universities. And sometimes it's not because of the cost of that, it's because the data is not organized in a database. No, things are a little bit more complicated in some places. So I was wondering if this is an opportunity of doing something that will be more universal because you don't need that data in some format, or it will be also a divide between universities that have or not have this possibility. Like things.
No, you're absolutely right. And I guess when I said most universities, I wasn't actually being kind of parochial, because I was not thinking of less well-researched universities in the global South. There's a broad spectrum of how much wealth universities have and colleges. And I certainly don't doubt that a place like Tec de Monterrey will have the ability to use these kind of technologies. A lot of universities in Mexico, which is a middle-income country, will have the opportunity. Probably not everywhere in Mexico. Probably not everywhere in the U.S. There are certainly some universities that are really hitting financial problems in the U.S. And even though GPT 3.5 tokens are cheap and will get cheaper because there'll be more competition with comparable things, it's not going to be free. There are universities that can't, where people can't afford textbooks in some parts of the global south, particularly in Africa and South Asia. So I don't doubt that you're right, that there will be some lower penetration. At the same time, any university that can afford a computing infrastructure, GPT tokens are going to get cheaper and cheaper over time. These things are going to be very cheap, I predict. I could be wrong. And so I think that, and it'll get cheaper to run them. So I expect that the penetration of learning analytics methods from the previous generation required some degree of expertise, some degree of expertise in data management, some degree of expertise in data science. These technologies today require so much less expertise that I think they will be much faster to disseminate than the previous generation of AI around the world. So if I make an analogy, it's like the laptop and the cell phone, right? Like cell phones were a technology that spread very quickly around the world, even to very historically poor communities where laptops didn't. And I think generative AI, which by the way, works on your cell phone, works on my cell phone. I think that generative AI will be something very similar that will spread like the phone, not the laptop. But Meta AI, ChatGPT requires a 4G or 5G connection, but Meta AI through WhatsApp can run on a 2G.
Yes, you're right. It could be more democratic than other types of tool in terms of access, and we don't need a lot of technology and connectivity on the side of the client, and also cost is being reduced. It's free if you use it on tools like Bing, et cetera, so there'll be more competition, no? And these tools will are improving at a pace that is very fast, not even, some people said even faster than Moore's Law. So in the future, we expect to have much better tools. So I want to ask you a twofold question. What kind of things will see in artificial intelligence, in education, in AI, that we don't see right now? And if this will transform profoundly what the universities are, or will create a different way of learning that could be at university or another thing?
Well, I will freely confess that I don't always have a good view on the future, because I feel like I realized what large language models were going to do about 2 months ahead of everybody, the average person. Like, which doesn't make me feel very proud, because I know people who figured it out 2 or 3 years before me. First of all, that sheer fact that you can use WhatsApp or Bing chat on your phone to interact with these things is just revolutionary. Like, people are, and in languages that, you know, it's quite good, as I'm sure you know, in Spanish and Portuguese, the languages that I know well enough, Spanish, Portuguese, and Korean, it's excellent. I've heard it's not great for every language, but the mistakes it makes are still relatively minor. It's still able to communicate in a whole lot of languages, including minority languages. EdTech was never developed for minority languages historically. You'd always see stuff in English, Chinese, maybe Arabic or Spanish. You'd never see it in Tamil, which is not a tiny language. Now people can use it in all those languages. So it's going to offer access to educational opportunities and to, like, asking questions and doing activities to people who never had them. And yeah, there'll be a little learning involved, but the learning curve will be so much easier than learning to program a computer was, or other learning. So I think it's going to greatly democratize things around the world. Also, it's going to democratize for topics. Intelligent tutor level technology has been feasible for things like automated essay scoring for introductory composition and intelligent tutoring for Algebra 1 and calculus, topics where there are lots and lots of students, and so it's worth the money. Now you can have these technologies.
It's because there's a lot of initial cost for the setup of these traditional adaptive learning cognitive tutor systems.
Exactly. And now you can use it for a much wider long tail of topics. We never could have realistically made an intelligent tutor dialogue forum posting thingy for my courses. There just wasn't the demand. Now we can, and for lots of other courses. My colleague Monta's using it in a game design class. So just smaller, rarer topics. So it enables us to get to reach a broader set of learners and a broader set of topics.
And how do you think this will has the potential to transform the way that universities are organized, or to create a type of university of learning organization or whatever? Do you have some thoughts?
I think universities are pretty conservative organizations in terms of sticking with, I mean, in some ways, the university has not radically transformed its structure in a long time, right? Like the model in the United States, I don't know the history of Mexican universities as well. In the United States, the model that Johns Hopkins brought from Germany was a model that had been there for a while. There are recognizable elements of the modern university going back to Bologna in Italy, and even to a university in what was at the time Constantinople. So I guess I think that the textbook didn't replace professors. The MOOC didn't replace professors. Those didn't change the overall structure of the university. And I don't think these technologies will either. I think we'll still have professors teaching courses, but the learning activities in those courses and the day-to-day work of those professors might look very different.
So I agree with you, but I think that there may be some changes, like a trend to personalization, have more personalization, because it will be less if to do that and to have students being advancing at their own pace. And also for me, it's very interesting the promise of adapting the material for more inclusion. So students that need a different type of material, that have some gaps needed to learn the material, that this relatively easy to do tutors will help those students to accommodate better their learning needs. It's fascinating for me. So if we go into that direction, it means that maybe the way that universities or learning is organized could change, in terms of not everyone is advancing at the same time or supposed to be advancing at the same time, because we know students doesn't advance at the same time. It's more the curriculum now that is going is a time constraint. Maybe that can change the way that at least education in terms of courses is organized in universities.
You might be right. I tend to be more of a skeptic on that it will change that. I think that's because the course unit, first of all, not all universities in the world use the course unit. The British system, a lot of universities use smaller units. So the unit isn't a necessity. All these universities in America use the same course unit, and in many other countries as well, not because it's the right way to teach information, not because it's the right grain size. Oftentimes, my courses would benefit from being a little longer or a little shorter, but because it's what we've done, and it's convertible. It's for accreditation and it's for transcripts, not for education. So, personally, I think that that large language models and modern AI—they're coming. If you're a textbook, they're coming for you. If you're a homework assignment, they're coming for you, and they're going to make it, like you said, way more sensitive, way more individualized, way better. But I have the sense that we're still going to have professors overseeing courses, or in the UK, modules.
Let's see what the future has for us. Challenges like ethical consideration, privacy considerations that we have to take into account. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think there are both ethical. I think there are definitely ethical considerations. To me, one of the ethical considerations becomes, when we've trained a generation using these tools, can they do some of the things? And there's been these debates throughout human history about when new technologies appear, writing. You know, there are accounts of people in ancient Greece saying now that there's writing, people don't memorize things like they used to, and knowledge isn't the same. So it's going to change what it means to be a scholar and what it means to be a learner. And that will have implications and it will have effects. I think on the whole, the ethical implications of these technologies are positive, that they create more opportunities to be beneficent, more opportunities to support people. I think those are good things. There are issues of bias and algorithmic bias in these models. That's a real thing. But that's also true of human instructors who are biased. Finally, privacy. I mean, OpenAI makes a legal guarantee that they're going to discard your data after 30 days and that it will only be retained for checking for abuse. I tend to believe that because they'd have so many people suing them if they were lying about that. Ultimately, the only difference between, in a lot of ways, between computer-based technologies and humans is that with previous approaches, people kind of, who maybe you could walk down the hall and see, or they were in a building two buildings away, had access to your private information. Now it's people far away. But in a lot of ways, the large language models, these guarantees of deletion after a month are actually much stricter than previous educational technologies yet. So if anything, we're moving towards a more an environment of greater privacy protection than we had a year ago.
Well, so I see that your vision for the future is mostly positive on the use of AI in education.
It's almost entirely positive. I think that it expands the capability of what it is to be, what you can do as a person and as a scholar. If I had worries, I do sometimes worry about the creation of new art and new literature. I worry a little bit that we haven't talked much about image models, but image models are based on corpuses of real images by artists. And I wonder if those artists will appear to the same extent in the next generation. But that's a challenge in some ways for the use of these technologies by humanity as a whole, not for their use in education. I think in education, if humanity is adopting these technologies, I think the use of them in education will be very benign.
Maybe that would become like graphs art. No? So you should have stuff that comes from a machine that needs something and stuff that is needed by hand, and it has special value because it's made by humans.
It's a great point. Yeah, I think you might be right. And Neal Stephenson's novel, Diamond Age, actually explores that and explores the long-term niche of craftspeople in a world where most things are mass produced by machines. I think it's very true.
It's not the only the usability of things or the utility of things is also the value of the process, no? It's put into that. As in art, particularly more in art, it's all about intellectual things more than the art itself, I think.
You know, who wants their spouse to give them a poem written for them by GPT? Even if it's a better poem in all artistic senses, you still want the love poem written by your spouse.
Even if it's crappy.
Even if it's crappy. And I'm very lucky for that because my poetry is crappy.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ryan. I've enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure that our audience will enjoy it too when they hear it. Thanks for sharing you the visions of the future, and I expect to have you back in Monterey very soon.
Oh, that would be a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
For more information, visit observatory.tech.mx/edutrendspodcast and ife.tech.mx. A special thanks to Tecnológico de Monterrey, the Institute for the Future of Education, and the Tech Sounds team, Edutrends producers Esteban Venegas and Christian Higosa. Stay tuned and play Tech Sounds in your favorite podcast app for other great shows and content.
Hola, soy Karina Rodríguez.
Y yo soy Mariana León.
Y te invitamos a escuchar Historias para Mentes Curiosas,
el podcast de Tech Science, en donde te contamos cómo la ciencia impacta en tu vida.
Historias para Mentes Curiosas es parte de Tech Sounds Podcast,
la barra oficial del Tecnológico de Monterrey.